United States, to be from the South isn't always a comfortable thing. A whole lot of assumptions get made about your politics and the way you view the world by people who live in cities located in the northern half of America. That's why I'm really excited about today's guest, who lives in Nashville, Tennessee, and who before that was raised in Alabama. This is the first guest we've had on the show to talk about nature in a southern city. She's the author of two books and many, many op-ed pieces for the New York Times, where she writes a weekly column. I'm Jill Riddell, and this is The Shape of the World.
Hi, I'm Margaret Wrinkle. I'm the author of Late Migrations, A Natural History of Love and Loss, and of Graceland at Last, Notes on Hope and Heartache from the American South.
Margaret, welcome to The Shape of the World.
Thanks so much for having me, Jill.
So, Margaret, I'm so glad that you're on the show, and I'm really eager to plunge into talking about Graceland at Last. I also want to mention that it has a nice subtitle to it, Notes on Hope and Heartache from the American South. It's a book where you closely observe the natural world and also the human world, which is a lot about what we're up to on The Shape of the World as well. I'd love to talk first about the title and the use of that word Graceland. Why did you give it that name, and what does the word Graceland evoke for you?
Well, the title of the book comes from the title of the final essay in the book, Graceland, which is the home of Elvis Presley in Memphis, Tennessee. The place had a special meaning for me long before I ever got there, years, decades before I ever got there, because of that Paul Simon song, Graceland, and a kind of a funny story about listening to it with a cat latched to my head as I drove over Mont Eagle Mountain, moving to Tennessee from graduate school in South Carolina. And I always thought that I would get to Graceland once I was in Tennessee very soon after arriving. But our families were all to the east of Nashville and Memphis is to the west. And it took a very long time for me finally to get to Graceland. And so that essay is the story of my trip to Elvis's home and what it meant to me. I chose it as the title of the book because I think it has, even for people who don't know anything about Elvis Presley and don't know anything about the South or don't know anything real about the South, it might evoke the kind of thing I want my homeland to be, which is a place of grace. And I don't think we are there yet, but I have hope that we are getting there.
I love both the word grace and the word land. And I love the compound structure of that together. I thought about it as I was looking at your book. When I first received it, it made me think about where Elvis got the name in the first place. Like, why did he call it Graceland? It turns out that Elvis bought the house from a woman who had inherited it from her aunt. And her aunt's name was Grace. And then I got laughing because I was thinking, well, that would be a little bit like, you know, if you're and my nieces named their houses that they had inherited from us, Margaret Land and Jill Land, that for him, like for it was really about a woman's name. And I also found out that it was the second most visited home in all of America after the White House. You would have been too little to have been listening to Elvis Presley when Elvis Presley was popular, but did you have any kind of relationship or thoughts about Elvis before landing at the tour of his mansion? Which you finally do, I will say, in the end of that essay, you do finally get there.
I do. And I have to say, I think that the name meant probably more to Elvis than just its exact derivation might suggest, just because he was a gospel singer. He came up in churches and the word grace would have meant something very specific to him as a Christian. It would have meant an unearned gift. I think he was aware his whole life of having come from nothing, truly from nothing, a dirt floor shack. And he never forgot that. Many times it must have seemed quite unbelievable to him.
When you were young, you grew up in a more rural area, small town, and not in a city. Is that correct?
We moved to Birmingham when I was 7.
Okay.
So Birmingham's a pretty big town, But would you believe this? I had never been to downtown Birmingham until I graduated from high school. We lived just barely over the mountain in a little suburb called Homewood, really 3 miles from Birmingham, but we just never went into town. I had an internship in a high rise downtown the summer before college, and that was my first real experience of the city, of learning that avenues went one direction and streets went the other. That kind of thing was new to me.
It's so interesting. I mean, the subject of this podcast is about cities and about nature. And it is true that, like a lot of other kinds of non-human animals, we tend to stay in pretty close areas. Like, so in Chicago, where I live, there are a lot of people who've never seen Lake Michigan, which is basically the big scenic destination. But a lot of people just don't make it out of their neighborhoods. So I think it's probably not that unusual.
Well, when you're a child of the 70s, cities, so many cities, especially in the South, had been really hollowed out. There were no department stores anymore, no historic theaters or concert halls.
And do you have a relationship with big cities now, or do you enjoy them? Do you try to stay away from them?
I find them extremely overwhelming. I have to go to New York fairly regularly. I write a weekly essay for the New York Times opinion section. It's fascinating. It's energizing. It's sublime and beautiful in a way that nothing else is sublime and beautiful. And it wears me out for every 24 hours I'm in New York. It takes me a good solid week to recover.
So, Margaret, there are so many interests that we share. It's hard to decide what to talk about in this short period of time we have together. But I decided that it might be nice for us to talk about lawns. I share your somewhat morbid fascination with rectangles of mowed grass. For a few years, I was in charge of exhibitions at a natural history museum in Chicago. And one of the exhibits that I hatched the idea for and then curated and brought into existence was an exhibition we called Lawn Nation, The Art and Science of the American Lawn, and where we invited artists to kind of riff on lawns, to make work about lawns, and then to deliver some more serious messages about the ecological implication of lawns. And I was wondering if you'd be up for reading a bit of the chapter America's Killer Lawns.
Sure. America's Killer Lawns. One day last fall, deep in the middle of a devastating drought, I was walking the dog when a van bearing the logo of a mosquito control company blew past me and parked in front of a neighbor's house. The whole vehicle stank of chemicals, even going 40 miles an hour. The man who emerged from the truck donned a massive backpack carrying a tank full of insecticide and proceeded to spray every bush and plant in the yard. Then he got in his truck, drove two doors down, and sprayed that yard too, before continuing his route all around the block. Here's the most heartbreaking thing about the whole episode. He was spraying for mosquitoes that didn't even exist. Last year's extreme drought ended mosquito breeding season long before the first freeze. Nevertheless, the mosquito vans arrived every 3 weeks, right on schedule, drenching the yards with poison for no reason but the schedule itself. And spraying for mosquitoes isn't the half of it, as any walk through the lawn care department of a big box store will attest. People want the outdoors to work like an extension of their homes, fashionable, tidy, predictable, above all, comfortable. So weedy yards filled with wildflowers get bulldozed end to end and replaced with sod cared for by homeowners spraying from a bottle marked backyard bug control, or by lawn services that leave behind tiny signs warning lawn care application, keep off the grass. If only songbirds could read. Most people don't seem to know that in this context, application and control are simply euphemisms for poison. A friend once mentioned to me that she'd love to put up a nest box for bluebirds, and I offered to help her choose a good box and a safe spot for it in her yard, explaining that she would also need to tell her yard service to stop spraying. I had no idea those guys were spraying, she said. To enjoy a lush green lawn or to sit on your patio without being eaten alive by mosquitoes doesn't seem like too much to ask, unless you know that insecticides designed to kill mosquitoes will also kill every other kind of insect, spiders and mites, honeybees and butterflies, native bees and lightning bugs. Unless you know that herbicides also kill the insects that ingest the poison plants. The global insect die-off is so precipitous that if the trend continues, there will be no insects left 100 years from now. That's a problem for more than the bugs themselves. Insects are responsible for pollinating roughly 75% of all flowering plants, including one-third of the human world's food supply. They form the basis of much of the animal world's food supply as well. When we poison the bugs and the weeds, we are also poisoning the turtles and tree frogs, the bats and screech owls, the songbirds and skinks. Changing our relationship to our yards is simple. Just don't spray. Let the wildflowers take root within the grass. Use an oscillating fan to keep the mosquitoes away. Tug the weeds out of the flower bed with your own hands and feel the benefit of a natural antidepressant at the same time. Trust the natural world to perform its own insect control and watch the songbirds and the tree frogs and the box turtles and the friendly garter snakes return to their homes among us.
So there's so much in that about the power of what's outside and our attempt to try to make it be more like the inside. And, you know, one of the things that I found when people were coming to see the museum exhibit that I mentioned was some people really, really did love that green rectangle and took a lot of pleasure in making it perfect. And there was no way that they were going to change their minds about that. But so many people that came to that exhibit felt much more ambivalent about the lawn, that that really was a place where there was room for change, because people seemed to have a real love-hate relationship with their lawn, and they sort of accepted it as a default landscape, like, well, that's what I got to do. That's the way I bought the house. It has this lawn, and that's what I'm doing. But I did feel like people were really looking for different alternatives. Have you found that to be true? Do you feel like people have been receptive to some of the ideas that you have in there? Have you seen a change at all?
I don't have a lot of success in changing my own neighbors' minds about it. I think part of it is peer pressure. Part of it is if everyone else is doing it and your most important investment of your life is your home, you're going to spend 30 years paying for it. Some of what they do because they think it would detract from their property value. It might limit their resale value in the future. Part of it is just habit. This American fascination with the lawn has been going on for decades. So most people who are mowing their own grass today never knew anything different.
Tell me what your yard looks like.
I have about a half acre. It's it's a corner lot, and it is very scruffy looking compared to my neighbors. When the leaves fall in the autumn, we leave the leaves, because when you let leaves lie, the insects have a place to overwinter. And when the insects have a place to safely overwinter, then the songbirds have insects to eat in the warm weather in the spring. The wildflowers are popping up, the spring ephemerals, spring beauties, and violets. Dandelions, of course, but a whole unbelievable host of others. They're called spring ephemerals because they come out before the hardwood trees leaf out. So they make use of sunshine that isn't going to be available very long. And most of those little flowers they're all over my yard, and they came from God. I didn't plant them.
They came from grace.
Yes.
So if someone was eager to make some kind of a change in their yard, they were hesitant about perhaps doing everything all at once, what would you recommend as one good first step?
Stop. You don't have to do anything. You just have to stop doing things. So instead of mowing every single week, mow less often. Pick areas of your yard that you don't mow at all. Leave patches along the property line in the back, perhaps, where it wouldn't bother somebody else. We leave our whole side yard unmowed all summer. When we have to mow, we wait till the wildflowers are bloomed out. We wait till they set seeds and drop their seeds, so we'll have wildflowers again next year. And then we set the mower at its highest setting to protect little bunny nests that are in the yard, to protect turtles and snakes, frogs that might be there. The very easiest first thing to do is just to stop doing what you are doing. Don't spray for mosquitoes. Just stop doing those things.
I like that idea of, instead of coming up with a list of tasks, of that idea of even more than benign neglect. I hear it as sort of a loving neglect, a chance for something else to grow.
Like the Tennessee Wildlife Federation has a way to get your yard certified as a wildlife habitat. Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation, you can get your yard certified by the Xerxes Society as a pollinator habitat. And the requirements for those certifications are so slight. Anyone could do that. I mean, you need, for example, shelter. Well, that shelter can be a nest box and a brush pile so that little creatures have a place to escape from aerial predators. They can dash into the brush pile. You could put out a shallow dish, a little tray that goes under a clay pot, and fill it with water. So when it's dry, the squirrels have something to drink, and the possums and the raccoons too. It's not hard.
You know, there's a lot of bad news on a daily basis about nature and the environment, and both what we encounter in the media and also what we see firsthand in the regions that each of us lives in. And Margaret, I have to ask, like, what do you do with all the bad news about nature and the environment? How do you find an element of peace and an ability to move forward in a positive direction with all of the bad news?
I just have to remind myself that despair is as much the enemy as inaction is. The problem with despair is that it is so enervating. It prevents you from believing there's any point in trying. So I recognize the danger of despair. I recognize my own tendency toward it. And I try actively to look for the stories that will make me believe that all is not yet lost. It's hard to find those stories on a national level. They really can only be found in the microcosm. If you look only on a planetary level, it's so dispiriting, it's hard to believe there's any hope. But when you understand that how many of the young people are aware of what we're facing, it's easier to keep trying.
You must get people coming up to you at book signings or acquaintances grabbing you when they see you at a social event who lament about how upset they are about the climate or species extinction or maybe a tree that got cut down that they loved. And they probably ask you, like, what can I do? What action can I take? What advice do you give them?
I think that people do better when they're helping, even if they're helping only a tiny bit. You know, I've planted so many trees and so many native shrubs in this yard. There isn't any way I can keep pace with the trees that have been cut down just since we've lived here, because we live in a neighborhood where human beings can't buy houses anymore. Only developers can afford. They get in bidding wars and they buy houses and they scrape them off the lots and they put up monster houses and they cut down so many trees in the process to put in, you know, a 7,500 square foot house on a half acre lot. You have to clear a lot of trees to do that. I can't keep up with that. But every time I plant a tree and I see a native bumblebee on the flowers in the springtime, or I see a migrating warbler perched in the branches grabbing insects, you know, from the backsides of leaves, I feel that there is a purpose in doing that. It's that old story about the starfish, you know, the little girl throwing starfish back into the sea that have been washed up in the tide, and somebody on the beach saying to her, you can't possibly throw all of these starfish back into the sea. You can't make a difference. And the little girl says, I can make a difference to this one. And I think that that helps. It may, plenty of people, especially the dialogue online, is really so dispiriting, because whenever somebody does try to do something good, there would be this chorus of voices saying, you can't make a difference. It's pointless. It's worse than pointless, because it makes people think that they're doing enough, whatever they're doing. They can recycle, or they can compost their kitchen scraps, or they can stop spraying the yard, and then they can get in their monster SUVs and go driving off on errands to the tune of 8 miles per gallon. But I don't really think that's true. I think when people start making small differences in their own lives, then they become empowered. They feel happier. And joy has a great motivating quality to it. So it's easy to then reach for the next rung up to say, okay, well, I'm composting now. Now I'm going to plant an organic garden. Now I'm going to plant for the pollinators. And I'm going to make sure I have a variety of native milkweeds for the migrating monarchs. There's just always one more step you can take, and it feels good.
It does feel good. And I think you're right. It's an iterative process like any other. You take the step that's there for you to take, the one that perhaps you feel drawn to. There are so many things that can be done, and some of them we feel more of an affinity with than we might with others. And starting to take one action is better than nothing.
And you have to have faith, too, that you're not doing it alone. Like, I drive an electric car. That's not a feasible choice for somebody who commutes long distances every day, but I don't. I commute to a little office off my bedroom, and I don't really drive very far. So for somebody who's doing more driving, there might be something else that person does. We don't all have to do everything. But we can have faith that everybody's doing something, and collectively we can make a big difference.
If you could change one thing about the world, do you have a favorite? Is there one little thing or one big thing that if you had a magic wand and you could wave it, that you'd make different?
Oh, sure. We have a lot of different sources of anxiety right now, but what it all really comes down to is climate change and the loss of biodiversity. If we could fix those two things, we could go back to worrying about smaller things. But since we aren't fixing them, they are particularly the climate piece, but also the biodiversity piece, especially where the insects are concerned with the pollinators. If we can't get those things sorted out, the other things we worry about will be made so much worse in the world that's coming. The income disparity, the racism, the misogyny, ugly things that happen when people are under duress will be made so much worse.
Yes, you're right. When I was reading your book, I was thinking about how you had your chapters arranged, and you do write a lot about nature, but you also do write about the social side of things, and they are very integrated and interrelated.
We have a bad zero-sum mindset in our political discourse now, that you can't be concerned about, let's say, abortion rights, or you can't be concerned about immigration, or you can't be concerned about racism, because if you're concerned with those things, you're not sufficiently concerned about this other thing that's so terrible. I understand how we've gotten to that point. If you worried about everything, if you put all of your energy into fighting injustice in one form and you let yourself think too much about the injustices in all the other contexts, it would be demoralizing. But you don't have to pick. You can pick the one you think you have the chance to make the biggest difference in, without believing that efforts to ameliorate injustices in other contexts are in some way taking away from your effort. That's where we need to get to. We need to get to the point where you fight your fight and I'm cheering you on, and I fight my fight and you cheer me on, and we all understand that ultimately we're working for a better country and a better world, and it's okay if we can't all do everything.
It's like the advice on the lawn. You can start somewhere.
I just always think that's the easiest place to start, because the easiest place to start is just to stop. I mean, if people would recognize how much easier their lives would be, how many more hours they would have on Saturday, if they were comfortable with a certain level of scruffiness. See, I look at my lawn, and to me, it looks rich and beautiful and wild and true. And I look at my neighbor's lawns, and it looks like a desert. It looks like a void. It looks like something painted in a picture that isn't real. And people walk around the neighborhood and they in early June, and they see the lightning bugs under the trees. We still have lots of trees in our yard, and the lightning bugs come out at dusk, and it's beautiful, but they stop at our property line by and large because we aren't spraying.
Margaret, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was such a delight to be with you, Jill. Thank you for having me.
This is Jill Riddell. In the next episode, I'll be talking with David George Haskell, an author best known for a book that, when it came out a few years ago, people kept coming up to me and asking me if I'd read it yet. That one was called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. And it really made an impact on how I and how many others think about trees. David has a new book out called Songs Wild and Broken, and it's going to be fun to speak with someone from the audible side of nature and cities rather than the visual. The shape of the world, of course, is all about nature, cities, and people, and the world we share. It's a production of the Office of Modern Composition, a business that creates compositions and fosters composers. If you have a story to tell, the Office of Modern Composition can help you get it done. They can go all DIY and teach you how to write and produce the story yourself, or they'll do the whole thing for you. Either way, you can end up with a permanent archival piece that presents your ideas and experiences. The Shape of the World is produced in the vital, vigorous, and beautiful metropolis of Chicago in the prairie state of Illinois. The Shape of the World is a completely carbon-neutral endeavor, thanks to reductions we made and from a carbon offset purchased from Tradewater. If you're interested in eliminating your carbon footprint, go to the website tradewater.us. You can find Shape of the World on Instagram and on the website shapeoftheworldshow.com. There you'll find out more about Margaret Rinkel's work and a drawing of her by the artist Nicole V. Hill. This episode of The Shape of the World was produced by Emily Beanblossom. Our Instagram account is managed by Ian Wenzel. The theme music is composed by Brad Wood. Special thank you to Milkweed Press, a publishing house that I greatly admire. It published Margaret Rinkel's most recent book and helped put the two of us in touch. And thanks to today's guest, Margaret Rinkel. In a couple of weeks, we'll be back with Season 5's final episode.